I'm very happy now to welcome back to the Radio Cafe Michael Brown. He's president of the School for Advanced Research. He's author of the new book, Upriver, The Turbulent Life and Times of an Amazonian People. And he will be speaking on Monday, February 9th at 6 o'clock at the Hotel Santa Fe. It's part of the Southwest Seminars Lecture Series. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
So this is a book about your work that really spans a wide range of years. When you were a young anthropologist in the late 1970s, you went to Peru, and you ended up living and studying with the Aguaruna people, also, I mean, they're, as they call themselves, and maybe you can help me with the pronunciation.
So they were known historically as Aguaruna, but their own self-denomination was Awahun, which is closely related to it, and starting in the late 1980s, they started using that in preference to Aguaruna. So the early the stuff I wrote and other people have written usually says Aguaruna, but Awahun is now the preferred ethnonym for them.
Awahun. Okay, so how did you find yourself choosing them and living with them?
To some extent, they chose me. I got a grant. I mean, I was 26. I received a fellowship to research a different group, the La Mista people, who geographically aren't that far away, but a very different culture, very different social situation. And for various reasons, it just didn't work out. I just didn't feel that it was what I wanted to do, partly because they had been involved in colonial relations so long and so discriminated against. They were very reserved. It was very difficult to work with them. I mean, if I'd taken years, I'm sure I could have gotten somewhere with it, but for various reasons I decided to explore other possibilities. And so I literally walked into, and I'm shortening a much longer story, which I tell in the book about how I got there. I walked into one of their villages and I said, "Can I stay here?" And they said, "Sure." And I think they mostly wanted to study me. So the Awahun are a completely different type of community. They're famous warriors in Peru. They've never been conquered by anybody. Their sense of themselves, their pride, their sense of cultural integrity and power was totally different from that of La Mista. So in some ways they were a lot of fun to deal with because they just didn't have a chip on their shoulder. They didn't feel subordinated to anybody. If anything, they have too high an opinion of their abilities, and I don't think they fully realized what they were up against as the Peruvian state began to move into their part of the Amazon. So I asked permission to live in the community. I said I wanted to just study their language and culture, and the people in that village said, sure. So a couple of weeks later, I came back with some gear, and they gave me a little guest house to live in. And I didn't know one word of their language when I landed, and so part of this challenge was, you know, learning to communicate. There was a couple of people in the village who spoke some Spanish, but in terms of, you know, getting a deeper, more profound understanding of their society, I had to learn to speak Awahun.
Which is a very difficult process, I would think, and some of it involves talking with children.
Yes. Well, the kids had the time and the inclination to kind of listen to my baby talk, and so I spent a lot of time trying out my language skills, which are only modest at best, on them. And one good thing about the society is that they have highly ritualized ways of communicating with one another, so they're kind of patterns that I could practice with the kids. So a typical interaction would be you stand outside somebody's house and you say, "Yatsuhu pohamek," which literally means, "Brother, do you exist?" And the person inside, if he's willing to receive guests, would say, "Puhahai, I exist." And then I would ask, "May I come in?" And he would say, "Yes, come in." And then I would say, "May I sit down?" And he would say, "Yes, sit down." So it's this sort of call and response thing, which was pretty good to get, you know, to break the ice. Of course, when you move into more complicated issues, magic, religion, even kinship, you know, the demands are much higher. But I started with the kids.
You paint such a vivid picture of what it's like to show up as an anthropologist. It takes you a half an hour to set up your little house, and then you're like, "Well, I'm here. What do I do now?" And it's like, "What do you do now?"
I'm
here to study. I don't know your language. I'm here to study your kinship. Like, what do they make of you?
Well, we spend a lot of time talking about that, and people. I mean, one thing, I was lucky because I landed at a time of the year that was the rainy season, so people, on rainy days, people mostly hang around in their houses and work on their tools and other kinds of gear, and they also drink a form of beer, which is the kind of social lubricant for their society. So it's made from cassava, or yuca, as you say in Spanish here, that's cooked, it's boiled, mashed, and then the women who are making it chew it up and spit it back into a container, which converts some of the starch into sugar and hastens fermentation, and then you let it sit for a while, it ferments, and then it's served up. And so we spend a lot of time drinking beer for the first couple of months, and so it's an opportunity. People are relaxed, they're telling jokes, they're telling stories. It was easy to hang out with them and try and understand what was going on.
So they're giving you beer, they're giving you a house. Basically, you're kind of their guest.
Right.
Did you have a sense that you had to give something back?
Well, one thing I did, the short answer is yes. The longer answer is that initially I didn't have much to offer them. I mean, again, this was shoestring field research. I didn't have a really big grant. I suppose by their standards I was wealthy, but by American standards today I was, I think I, my budget for 2 years was like $10,000 or something, including travel. So one thing I did was I actually took board with the village teacher. They had bilingual teachers who were trained by American missionary linguists, and so I paid him, I think, you know, 50 cents a day, and his wife gave me meals. I also provided ammunition, which I distributed in the village with the understanding, which was customary, that if they killed an animal with my ammunition, with my shotgun shell, then they would share the meat with me. But I was also helping to feed the village, because at that time ammunition was very expensive, so I could come with a box of 16-gauge shells and distribute them in the village, and that helped them hunt. And they were great hunters, terrific hunters.
The fact that you drank beer with them dispelled any worries that you were a Protestant missionary.
That's right. Yeah, they thought, they sort of assumed that I was a evangelical pastor or something like that, and that issue got cleared up pretty fast.
And other people at other times assumed you were CIA or intervening in some way.
Right. I mean, that meant nothing to the Awahoon at the time, but the local, you know, campesinos, many of them thought. And no one could imagine that I would spend their, you know, years in these remote villages unless I had some ulterior motive.
Tell us a little more about daily life. I mean, there's the rainy season and the dry season.
Right.
What did people do all day? I mean, there is this sense, at least some of the time, of real boredom. There's not that much going on.
Well, that's right. A typical day would start at about dawn. So people live in houses scattered. Actually, historically, they lived in these really isolated, highly fortified longhouses, which were under the leadership of a single senior man who might have multiple wives and sons-in-law living with him. And because it was a high level of violence, I mean, they're traditionally considered one of the most violent, historically one of the most violent people in the upper Amazon. They still scare the heck out of Peruvians, and they take advantage of that reputation. They, like their first cousins, the Shuar or Jivaro of Ecuador, took human heads and shrank them. So when you hear about shrunken heads, that was the handiwork of their ancestors. As they came under, as they received land grants and allowed schools into their elementary schools into their villages, the villages became more concentrated. So people clustered in these small villages of maybe 100 people, 200 people, in multiple houses. So early in the morning, the men, if they were going hunting, you'd see them walk by with their shotgun over their shoulders, maybe a blowgun if they were hunting monkeys, because they use poison darts for certain animals. And then the women would take their youngest children and head out to their gardens to do gardening work. And then the school, if it was a weekday, the teacher would call the younger kids to school. And so people were gone for a lot of the day, and so the question was, how do I spend my time when there's nobody around? And that was awkward sometimes. And I took field notes, but at the beginning I didn't really understand much of what was going on, so finding a way to keep from going crazy it's a classic problem for anthropologists, because you feel like a complete idiot.
Yeah. Did they ever take you hunting?
I went hunting sometimes, but as I mentioned in the book, hunting in the rainforest. I mean, your listeners can't tell that I have very strong glasses. I don't have particularly good eyes. I mean, I'd go out hunting with people, and they'd say, all right, Mayak, which was my name there, you know, there's a bird, you know, shoot it. And I'd go, I don't see anything. You know, you're just looking at this green vastness, and then they get tired of waiting and take a blast with a shotgun, and a bird would fall out of the tree. So I didn't want to hold up them or prevent them from being successful hunters, because that, so I didn't hunt that much. I did other things. I did gardening work with people. I went fishing when they went fishing. I tried to stay out of the way and participate in group things where my labor was useful.
Now, were they what one might call hunter-gatherers?
No, they're considered horticulturalists, so most of their calories actually come from gardens. And they're classic Amazon, you know, they're polycrop gardens. They probably have like 40 different species growing in the gardens, but cassava or yucca was the principal crop and the sort of thing that everybody ate every day. The staff of life, both as beer and as a vegetable, but they also had plantains, which are green bananas. They had a bunch of other root crops. They had herbal, they had fruit, some species of fruit that are not that familiar in this part of the world. So they actually traditionally had an excellent and highly diverse diet. That's been pared down as their access to land gets more restricted and as dietary preferences change over time.
We're talking to anthropologist Michael Brown about his book, Upriver, The Turbulent Life and Times of an Amazonian People. One of the things that, when you talk about the violence of these people, one of the sources of the violence is that they're very afraid of sorcery.
That's right.
And all kinds of feuds come up because they believe that somebody has performed sorcery on somebody else.
Right. So one of the things I talked about was that the village that I first settled in, which is called Huascayacu, seemed like a happy place. People were certainly cordial to me, but as the more time I spent there, the clearer it became that there was a lot of tension in the village because of they have a very high rate of infant mortality. I mean, like 30% of kids don't make it to age 5, and there were adult deaths as well. And so there were deep suspicions that there were sorcerers in the community. There's one man in particular who was feared as a sorcerer, though I could see nothing about him that lent itself or supported that view. But people, so the village was actually in the process of splitting up, and a couple of households peeled off to go to other places because they felt it was too dangerous to live there. So one of the things I came to understand was how much tension there was, which didn't express itself in direct violence at any time while I was there. But in other villages, it sometimes did. And so one of the things I explained in the book was a homicide that took place in a village that I eventually came to live in which a young man was accused of being responsible through sorcery of the death of a headman, much admired and respected person who died suddenly, probably of an aneurysm or a heart attack or something like that. And this 16-year-old boy was the scapegoat, and he was assassinated by a number of men. So it wasn't all theoretical. I mean, there's still a certain amount of real violence that was associated with that fear.
Now, in your view, what is sorcery?
Well, the funny thing is I kind of went to the field prepared to believe in sorcery. I think after a while I began to see it more as a tragic defect or illusion that made people's lives miserable. But anthropologists look at it a lot of different ways. I mean, in some cases, marginal people, deviant people are identified as sorcerers, and so it's a way of imposing a certain kind of discipline within a community by convincing them to change their behavior or convincing them to go away. But I never could make that kind of functionalist sense out of it with the Awahoon. I think it's that in a world where you live on the edge, and it's hard for us to appreciate just how close to the edge people live and how comfortable they are living at that edge, where they depend entirely on their wits. I mean, they had some technology, but it was pretty limited at the time. And, you know, people are dying all the time of snake bite and, you know, accidents. I mean, people are eaten by anacondas. I mean, all kinds of terrible things happen. And you're really only one accident away from injury or death. And children are dying all the time. And so you confront death in a way that I don't think many of us can understand, and so trying to find an explanation for it is where sorcery comes in.
There's a quotation in your book where you quote an anthropologist who's not talking about the Amazonian people in particular, but you quote the South African anthropologist Monica Wilson, who referred to, well, in her case it was belief in witches, but it also applies to the kind of sorcery you were seeing as, quote, the standardized nightmare of a group. What does that mean?
Well, in the Awahoon case, the reason I gravitated to her explanation, which was from the 1950s and is kind of out of fashion in anthropology, is that if you live in a highly agonistic or violent society where you're suspicious of a lot of people, then when you start being suspicious of your spouses, of your brothers, of your uncles, you know, the violence goes from the periphery into the heart of the community. There's really very, at least in traditional Awahoon societies, there were few sources of existential security, and I think that insecurity then manifested itself as this concern, or in some cases obsession with sorcery, which does continue to its day. It doesn't, to this day, it doesn't manifest itself in violence on a regular basis like it did in the past, but it's certainly a factor of life, even in, you know, 2015.
You know, just the way you went into the field ready to believe in all kinds of things, I went into this book ready to believe in whatever kinds of magic and other ways of perceiving the universe and things. And reading it, you just thought, oh my God, these people have so much life, and life energy is squandered on these crazy accusations.
It's true, and I don't know what to think about it. I mean, I think I say I found that disturbing and unsettling, but, you know, the other side of the coin, as you say, is just the kind of energy and vivacity and enthusiasm and that they have, and that has really stood them in good stead in the modern era. I mean, there are 55,000 of them now, and they're tough as nails, and they stick up for themselves, and people don't like to mess with them because they're ambitious, and their sense of self is very strong. It's quite remarkable.
And we'll get to that in a moment, because that's very important with respect to the encroachment of modern life and so-called civilization. But there was one more thing I wanted to ask you about, which was the phenomenon of suicide, which was also very important and common, especially among women. What was that about?
Well, again, dealing with small populations, it's hard to come up with, you know, suicide rates that are meaningful in modern terms. But in every village I visited and lived in, there was recent evidence of suicides, disproportionately of young women, but also of teenage boys to a more limited extent. And the only sense I could make of it was that it's a society focused on assertions of power, but that certain members of the society, including young men who haven't really achieved anything yet, and women are denied access to those forms of power. So they sort of enact power by, in a self-destructive way, rather than by asserting themselves vis-a-vis others. In the case of girls, and I say that advisedly because many girls were married by 14 or 15 at the time. They were extremely vulnerable. They were often married off to older men. There might have been one or two or even three other wives who they sort of had to negotiate a life with. Most of them had a very high birth rate, so basically their experience of life was pregnancy and nursing until they got well into their 40s, late 40s. And so they were very vulnerable, and I think one way that they could exercise some power and agency was to say to their husband, if you mistreat me like that, I will kill myself, and then my brothers and my father and my kin will come down on you, which actually happened. So the funny thing was that brothers and fathers and male relatives of a woman were unlikely to intervene in abusive cases until they came to the extreme point of, you know, the woman killing herself or attempting to kill herself, in which case the husband was then often blamed.
But that was a kind of leverage that did seem to work.
To some extent it did, yes. But it only works, of course, if, you know, you actually do it, if there's a history of actual suicides as opposed to suicide threats.
Which there is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very interesting. Now, did you feel like when you were there as a young man that you influenced them? I mean, I was sort of trying to imagine being in your shoes and coming in, and on some level you'd want to bring maybe some of your own levels of hygiene with you, or ways of doing things, or whatever. Do you feel like you rubbed off on them? Did they ask you to intervene in disputes?
Not too much. They actually did ask me, or some teachers asked me to intervene in the homicide case. But that was fairly soon after I got in the field. I didn't have any firsthand information, and I didn't have any confidence in the ability of the Peruvian police in this provincial area to intervene in a way that would actually apprehend the guilty parties, or even if, you know, arresting them would do any good. So I just decided to stay out of it. As I was more integrated into the community and I acquired some facility in the language, I did help them with, you know, document problems and sometimes dealing with government officials and so on, helping them understand and work through the bureaucratic system that they were coming into contact with. But I didn't really act to change their society. And frankly, the Awahoon are their own people. I don't think I really could have done that. And I mean, the missionary linguists who worked with them, mostly Americans, did have that effect, but the effect probably wasn't as profound as even they hoped it would be.
Right, right. We're talking to Michael Brown about his book, Upriver. So you left in 1978. You've been back since, but there have been long gaps between times that you've gone back to visit, and there have been very great changes in the ways of life and in the land, and a lot of forces of external capital of government. What does it look like now? What's happened in the intervening time?
Well, let me back up and just say that there were some things about their situation which were surprisingly positive in comparison to other Amazonian groups. So the area where they were living was colonized intensively by Andean people at about the time I arrived, but they happened to have lucked out in that they received fairly large land grants in the 1970s that gave them a land base that they could live on, which wasn't true for probably the majority of Amazonian peoples in Peru and other parts of Latin America, or sorry, other parts of South America. So they were, in this particular province where I worked, they were operating from a position of unusual strength. And as it happened then, agricultural development in this area really accelerated in the 80s and 90s. And so they found themselves by the early 90s sitting on very valuable real estate, very valuable agricultural land, first for rice production and later for shade-grown coffee. Now, we usually think of Amazonian development as being immensely destructive, involving deforestation and soil degradation. And there's some truth to that. Certainly, there's plenty of deforestation in the area. But they're in an upper Amazonian situation where there are ways of there are stable agricultural systems. It wasn't like just turning it into grassland for cattle, which was the problem in Brazil and elsewhere. So this is a more temperate climate where soils are a little bit better, where if you use wet rice agriculture, irrigated rice agriculture, as you see in Southeast Asia, it's a very safe, stable, self-sustaining system that protects agricultural lands in fragile tropical environments. So and likewise, shade-grown coffee is a pretty benign form of agriculture. But the problem is that they've been tempted to actually lease out their farmland to colonists who have the particular agricultural skills that allow them to use the, you know, more sophisticated techniques to engage in this agriculture. And so those Awahoon who are sitting on these valuable lands are mostly renting out their land to non-indigenous settlers. And the problem there is that eventually those people feel like they, you know, own the property that they have farmed and where they built houses and that sort of thing. So my concern is, and this is a concern shared by the more thoughtful Awahoon themselves, is that, you know, they might lose that land in the face of invasion by outsiders.
Well, and there's this whole thing that when, for example, land is taken away from them illegally, and then they have a court case and they win their court case, they still can't get the land back because the police or whatever authorities are unwilling to enforce court orders.
That's right. And there's a long history of peasant invasion of private land in Peru, which we, in some cases, anthropologists think is great and fair. But in this case, protecting indigenous lands from the far more numerous outsiders is something that the police and judicial authorities seem reluctant to do. Now, in one of the cases to which you're referring, and which I talk about in the book, the Awahoun eventually gave up on the judicial process and organized a war party and slaughtered 16 settlers.
Yeah.
And that was fairly recent. I think it was 2002.
Yeah, and so their violent and ornery ways stood them in good stead.
I suppose. I mean, it's a tragic situation, and they had exercised all, they'd done it absolutely by the book. They'd gone to court, they'd won case after case after case, and eventually the government just wasn't protecting their rights, and they felt that they had to take their rights, you know, they had to take the issue into their own hands.
Do you see parallels to Native Americans in the U.S.?
Well, there are many parallels. I mean, in a way, it was kind of like going back a century and watching, you know, watching the process, the same things that happened in various parts of the United States. For example, there's a big debate over their lands are communally held just as they are in federally recognized Indian reservations in the United States. And just as there's been this long debate that's gone on for 150 years about whether native lands should be privatized to encourage, you know, entrepreneurship and so on, but almost always that results in land loss. Likewise, the Awahoun and other Amazonian people are constantly being told, well, you know, this communal ownership thing just doesn't work in a capitalist system. You should have the right to do what you want with your own land, which, of course, ultimately almost always results in some kind of land loss.
So the Awahoun people are pretty numerous.
Yes.
How are they? I mean, when you look at the situation now, very different from when you were there 30, 40 years ago, how are they doing?
Well, it's hard to generalize because it's a large group. I actually got some land tenure information which showed that the total territory that they control right now is about the size of New Jersey. So we're talking about a vast and exceedingly difficult mountainous country. So it's on the eastern slopes of the Andes. So upriver, where the book title is kind of a metaphor for the fact, or stands for the fact, that unlike many Amazonian people who live on these slow rivers and travel by canoes, these are upriver people who live in this very difficult environment, semi-tropical or tropical, but hilly, muddy, transportation is tough, roads are terrible, and still are in some cases. So there are, plus it's a highly militarized border between Peru and Ecuador, which is where most of them live, and so this has been a hot border. There have been three or four wars over the frontier, now settled apparently, but so those Awahoun who live closest to the border area, I think, are on very small plots of land. Their communal land holdings are much more modest. I was lucky enough to be in the southernmost extreme, an area that hadn't been settled, as I said before, until fairly recently, and so they were able to grab much larger titles to, you know, larger tracts of land, which is why a lot of Awahoun are moving into that area to live with their kin, because the economic opportunities were significantly greater. So I'd have to say that there are many parts of Awahoun territory where people really are poor and are struggling, and there are others where, I mean, and where I worked, as it happened, just by chance, they're probably among the wealthiest natives and native peoples in South America, certainly in the Amazon. Because of the agricultural potential of where they live. But one thing that I really emphasized in the book is that they've made this transition from the kind of ambition of warriors to the ambition of people who want to be educated. I mean, they really, really value literacy. And one of the unexpected consequences of early contact with missionary linguists was not that they all became evangelical Christians, though some are, but that they all became literacy. They have one of the highest literacy rates in the Peruvian Amazon, and there are now university-trained students, and the book includes an interview with a man named Eduardo Nayap, who's the first Amazonian Indian to be elected to the Peruvian Congress. So he's a congressman in Peru, and he's a you know, by dint of circumstance, a spokesman for his people, and there are many others. So in that sense, they their ambition takes new forms, and their ambition is to become literate, to become players, and they're very entrepreneurial.
So if they're literate, does that mean that they're literate in Spanish?
In Spanish and Awahoon.
And so Awahoon is written?
Absolutely, yes. And that was because the missionary linguists who came from the Wycliffe Bible translators, their job was to do a translation, mostly of the New Testament, into Awahoon. And so they had to create an alphabet for Awahoon. And the alphabet they picked was pretty good. It was based on the Spanish alphabet, and there are a couple little sounds that you don't find in Spanish. But they wanted to keep it as simple as possible. So one of the odd things about my situation, when I landed in the community, everybody in the village had Bibles that had been provided by the Summer Institute of Linguistics and the Wycliffe Bible translators and their educational arm, which is called the Summer Institute of Linguistics. And I could read it orally. I could read it out loud because it was phonetic, but I didn't even understand what I was reading.
Right.
And they found that really odd.
One of the things that I really appreciate about this book is that it's what feels to me like a very interesting and fair discussion about the impossibility, really, of making clear moral judgments about a lot of things. I mean, missionaries, I think most people could probably agree, have done a great deal of harm, but they've also not only increased literacy, which we might think is good, decreased things like wife beating. I mean, there seems to be, with every change, maybe good and bad come from it, or maybe you can't even put those clear labels on it.
Well, one of the things that I wanted to explore in the book, and the advantage of coming back to this early work 35 years later, is to explore the law of unintended consequences, which is something that's always fascinated me. So when I was doing my work there, I was very hostile to American Protestant missionaries. I mean, who were perfectly nice people, but I didn't agree with what they were doing. And, you know, 30-plus years later, I began to see things quite differently, that, there was a price that the Awahoon paid. But at the same time, literacy probably improved their prospects for cultural survival dramatically, so that they could understand what was going on, they could generate documents to protect their rights, they could communicate effectively to outsiders. And in fact, they seem to be kind of indigenizing Christianity in ways that are consistent with their belief system. So, I suddenly could see that the young Michael Brown, that his highly judgmental and hostile attitude maybe hasn't been borne out in the way that I expected at the time, and that some significant good has come out of that contact and that experience.
There's also a very interesting discussion about the question of the role of anthropology, and there's people who feel that anthropology is a science, and others who feel that it's really a tool of activism. And sometimes that came to a head, and you described some real arguments with people who were judging what you were trying to do.
Yeah, that struggle continues to this day. I mean, I'm neither in the school of anthropology only as science, nor as anthropology primarily as activism. It seems to me you make certain moral and ethical commitments to the people you live with and who feed you and protect you and talk to you and make your career possible. And each of us has a different way of dealing with that. But at the same time, one of the effects of it is that some ethnographies of Amazonian people just make them seem like, you know, as I say, you know, tropical Dalai Lamas, you know, dancing around palm trees or something, and they don't really do justice to the moral complexity of these communities themselves, and they portray them in highly idealized ways that I don't think are entirely honest or accurate. So in the case of the Awahoon, I really wanted to provide a portrait of them as complex people with moral failings but also tremendous virtues and also a real sense of humor too. And that's one thing I want to emphasize. I mean, these books are often so dreary, you know, about the destruction of, you know, people being steamrolled by capitalism, all of which is true. But, you know, first of all, they fight back. They fight back with wit. They fight back with humor. Their creativity, their resourcefulness is really what the book is about. It's just these tough, funny, smart people who are making a life for themselves against tremendous odds. And so that admiring quality, to the extent that the book is political, that's what I wanted to communicate.
It's funny because we so-called civilized people have projected an awful lot through anthropology and through other kinds of literature onto so-called tribal or traditional societies. Mm-hmm. And it seems to vacillate between, there seem to be sort of two poles to this projection. One is the noble savage and one is the vicious savage.
Right. And the people like the Awahoon are neither. I mean, they're not perfect. They have flaws, and I talk about those, but they also have, you know, admirable qualities that over the years I've really come to admire. And I think I'm much more optimistic about their prospects, even though they face tremendous challenges and injustices, but their population has grown, their sense of cultural assertiveness has grown, they're one of the dominant and most politically active groups in South America. And so I'm pretty confident they're going to survive. And in fact, I just wrote something recently where I said, in, you know, a couple of generations, they're going to be running the place. And that wouldn't surprise me at all now.
It wouldn't surprise me either, particularly as the infrastructure on which we have built this globalized world has a lot of really scary weak points. Mm. And is sort of, you know, ready to collapse at any moment.
That's right. That's right. And, you know, but I want to say that they don't reject modern technology. I mean, even when I started working with them, they had shotguns that were made in Massachusetts and steel tools that were made in England. And
cell phones.
They didn't have cell phones more recently, but they all have cell phones now. And as I was saying earlier, they made fun of my poor technology. You know, they thought somebody from the United States should have a better cell phone than they did, but mine was terrible. And, you know, they all have radios, and you can see the occasional satellite dish and things like that. It's not that they reject technology, but they really want to make it work for them in their own way. They are committed to that.
So this book, Upriver, is kind of maybe a hybrid between academic anthropology and memoir.
Yes.
How did you come to write it now, all these years later?
Well, part of it is you reach a certain age and you feel liberated from some of the constraints of having to prove yourself in the academic world. And partly you just get the distance from an earlier experience. As I explained in the book, all my notes, this was all pre-laptops when I started, and so they were all handwritten notes, and I wanted to digitize the material, which meant I had to go through, you know, 800 pages of notes again, and then kind of revisit the Michael Brown of, you know, 1977 or whatever, which was sometimes a painful exercise and an embarrassing exercise, and sometimes I thought, yeah, you know, you did a pretty good job under the circumstances. But it also, I realized that there were stories that I'd never told. It was a way of telling them that I felt that I could do better now than I could back then. And I also wanted to just provide a really nuanced, human, close-in portrait of a resourceful group of people who are survivors. And in that sense, I didn't care so much about anthropological theory. The books, last couple of books that I've done, in fact, have been more popular. They kind of straddle the academic and the popular world, and that's, my editor is totally into that. And so that's what I wanted to do, and that was where I felt my gifts were, such as they are, were best deployed.
Michael Brown is president of the School for Advanced Research here in Santa Fe. They're on the web at sarweb.org. He's author of the new book, Upriver, The Turbulent Life and Times of an Amazonian People. And on Monday, the 9th of February, he will be speaking at 6 o'clock at the Hotel Santa Fe. It's part of the Southwest Seminars Lecture Series, and complete with photos and illustrations and things
like
that.
Absolutely, yes.
Well, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.